From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
So we'll start by asking you a bit about the founding of Dunkin' Donuts.
This is me just a few weeks ago prepping for a webinar that I was going to be doing with Robert Rosenberg, who was the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts from 1963 until 1998, when it was a family-run company, started by the Rosenbergs. And as I was saying this, a question popped into my head because, you know, Dunkin' Donuts is no longer called Dunkin' Donuts like Robert knew it to be. It's just Dunkin' now.
By the way, do you call it Dunkin' Donuts or do you now call it Dunkin'?
I call it both. Depends on which way I go. Don't be put off. I move back and forth between both names.
It's okay.
It's been hard for the donuts. I by the way, I do agree with the management's decision to change the name. And in fact,
You know what? Actually, can you don't tell me that.
Here's a pro tip if you are ever interviewing somebody on mic, on stage, anything. I learned this from a friend at This American Life, and I have operated on it ever since. If somebody's going to tell you something off mic that you think would be a good conversation subject on mic, tell them to stop and tell it to you live. Because once they've told it to you once, they're not going to say it the same way the next time. They're going to be repeating themselves. It won't be as magic, and you won't have the natural reaction. So I will interrupt anybody. I will interrupt the longtime CEO of Dunkin' Donuts if they're going to tell me something that I think belongs in the program. And speaking of the program, so Robert and I had connected for a webinar that originally ran on entrepreneur.com, but I want to share the conversation with you here as well because it is full of so many great insights. Robert didn't create Dunkin' Donuts. That honor goes to his dad, William Rosenberg, who opened Dunkin' Donuts originally under the name Open Kettle in 1948. But Robert is the guy responsible for turning Dunkin' Donuts into the brand that you know now, an international company. And it's funny, as I'm saying this, I'm realizing I'm calling it Dunkin' Donuts. It's called Dunkin' now, but it was Dunkin' Donuts back then. I understand why he keeps using both names interchangeably. So, Robert has written a great, really interesting book. It's called Around the Corner to Around the World, A Dozen Lessons I Learned Running Dunkin' Donuts. And it's very much about how to take a small business and then scale it out and the lessons that he learned and the mistakes that he made along the way. And in a time of great change like this one, I thought, what better moment to talk about a company that goes through a great change? Because you know what? Change can happen at any time. Growth can happen at any time. These were not easy years for Robert. Some of them were quite turbulent, but so, so interesting. And he's really broken down the lessons from it. So on this episode of Problem Solvers, it is my conversation with Robert Rosenberg of Dunkin/Dunkin' Donuts and how to take a small family company and turn it into something massive. Coming up after the break.
For business owners, saving time is everything because each minute saved can be put back into growing your business. So when you need a business loan, U.S. Bank makes the process quick and convenient. Meet with a banker or apply from anywhere with a simple and secure online application and get a decision in minutes. Save time with U.S. Bank so you can get back to what you do best, running your business. Apply today at usbank.com/fundmybusiness. Credit products offered by U.S. Bank National Association, Equal Housing Lender.
All right, we're back. So, like I said, this is a conversation with me and Robert Rosenberg, former CEO of Dunkin' Donuts, author of Around the Corner to Around the World, A Dozen Lessons I Learned Running Dunkin' Donuts. And we originally recorded this as a webinar for entrepreneur.com. And I began by asking Robert to explain his own introduction to Dunkin' Donuts, because, of course, we think of it as this omnipresent brand that is basically anywhere you go, there's a Dunkin'. There's a Dunkin'. But for Robert, this was a family company, a small family company. So let's go back to that moment.
It's a story I love to tell, and for a number of reasons. It's really a story about the role of chance, and in our case, second and third chances. I think, as most entrepreneurs know, plans don't always go according to their original concept. They oftentimes have to be reformulated. So I'll take you back and I'll set the stage. The business actually began after the Second World War. My father and my uncle were partners in a business that had a bunch of trucks that would go around to construction sites and small office sites and serve coffee in. And they grew that business rather rapidly after the Second World War. And they had a number of trucks, and they had a commissary, and they had depots all over New England. But vending machines came in, and their business started to falter, and they needed to, in their view, diversify. And lo and behold, the baker in the bakery that was making goods for the trucks said, you know, there's a store around the corner that basically sells donuts, and they have 12 wholesale trucks. They make more money from their one individual store than they do for all of their trucks. And that was just the right note for the two partners to keep their business dream alive. And they opened up a small shop in Quincy, Massachusetts, on a road that connected Boston to Cape Cod. And it was a stucco store with no windows. They called it the Open Kettle. It opened in 1948. And business was, to put it kindly, very slow and no different than all the other donut shops that had opened up. And to make matters worse, the guy across the street had a long string of space available. And he decided he liked the idea of donut shops. He's going to open a donut shop of his own. And the two partners, my father and my uncle, found out who his architect was. And before he hired him, they hired a guy by the name of Bernard Healy. And Bernard came on scene and he took a look at this stucco store with no windows. And he said, the product might be delicious and the coffee might be delicious, but no one knows what's going on inside. What you guys really have to do is you have to rip the store down. You have to rebuild it in a fishbowl look, a California style. Got to act and look important. And the name, Open Kettle, people don't know what you're doing.
Can I just interrupt to say that although that may all sound very obvious in retrospect, I feel like I see businesses all the time that miss these important things. I remember it was called pizza. Do you know what pizza is? It's a form of pizza. It's different. It's like Italian street food, and it's made in a different way, but it's basically pizza. It's pizza, but it's not pizza. It's delicious. Anyway, there was a place in my neighborhood right around the corner from me that sold pizza, not pizza. And they didn't put their food in the window, and the sign was said pizza. It didn't say pizza. It didn't even have a pizza-ish looking logo. And anyway, I was just like, oh, you guys are going to go out of business. And I don't know. I can't go in and like tell you how to run your business. That's not what I should be doing. But like, I was like, people don't understand. They don't understand what you're doing. You have to be clearer. And anyway, they did not survive, which made me very sad because the pizza was delicious. But anyway, you can see what's happening here. Dunkin' Donuts would have never been Dunkin' Donuts, would have never grown as Open Kettle. The hell is Open Kettle? Anyway.
So they sat around, they had a brainstorming session. Someone said, what do you do with a chicken? You pluck a chicken, what do you do with a donut? You dunk a donut. Red Skelton, the famous comedian of the 40s and 50s, had a whole bit about the etiquette of dunking a donut and a cup of coffee. My dad said, that's the name. So the Open Kettle that was doing $1,000 or $1,500 a week closed, and within a year, opened in 1950, a spanking new California-style store and a fishbowl environment where you could see the question mark counter and the customer sitting in taking coffee and the showcases all displayed, acting and looking important as Dunkin' Donuts. Same management, same product, same price, different name, different packaging, now doing $5,000 a week when coffee was selling for a nickel a cup and donuts for 55 cents a dozen. The beginning of an empire to come.
That's really a testament to the power of change, isn't it? And, you know, when we talk about change, sometimes it feels really scary because it's like, oh, you're going to have to throw everything out and start from scratch. No. I mean, they made good coffee, they made good donuts, but there were problems. There were barriers to entry, and you have to make changes. You have to think sometimes the most fundamental things, the name of the company, is actually the thing that's holding people back. So anyway, then I wanted to talk to Robert about what he saw when he walked into this company. And to be clear, by the time that Robert arrived, it wasn't just a little tiny donut stand. It was much bigger. At this point, his father had grown this company and also had a bunch of other brands, and they were all together in this one company. And Robert was invited at the age of 25 to come in and run the whole thing.
The business he asked me to take over was a company called Universal Foods, is a portfolio of seven little businesses. It had stagnated in terms of earnings, and my father and my uncle didn't get along. My father bought my uncle out in 1955. My uncle took the money and started a competitive donut chain, not burdened by all these other businesses, called Mr. Donut. You can just imagine dinnertime conversations. I mean, It was the emotional driving force behind the business. My dad tried to sell the company because it had stagnated. I was with my second year of business school. He took me with him to New York for a private equity guy, and they weren't willing to pay him the million or so dollars he wanted to have. He wanted to always, his dream was to be a millionaire. And he had an executive vice president running the company. And while I was in business school, I had an opportunity to think through and had a hunch as to how to fix the business. And he had turned to me and asked me if I wouldn't assume at 25 the CEO-ship of the company. I took about 6 weeks to study what was going on and to decide if my hunch that I had in business school was correct. And looking at it, I thought the problem really was the leadership of the business and that the business really required focus. I came to the conclusion, even at a young age, that you know, a new business can starve to death by virtue of not having enough resources, people, and money, can also die from indigestion, having too much. And that was my conclusion. This was a business that was tackling much more than it could handle, much broader than it had resources for. And so when I joined, I decided with the team that we were going to narrow the focus. We were going to take one of those businesses that was in our midst, this sort of diamond in the rough, Dunkin' Donuts. And the business, Dunkin' Donuts didn't look like it looks today. It basically, the last 26 stores the management had opened was serving scrambled eggs and hamburgers and hot dogs. And it was more a diner. There was no standardized seating. It could have been anywhere from 18 seats to 90 seats. So we decided to focus on one design, one menu, one business, starve the other businesses of resources and slowly but surely exit them. And that was the way we began to run the business. And we were incredibly successful. I wanted to keep the business in the family. I had to go public rather quickly. So earnings went from 1963, $100,000 before taxes to $800,000 within 5 years. And we were the third company to go public in order to satisfy my dad's desires and equitize some of his holdings. And unfortunately, the next 5 years, I wish I could say were just as successful as the first. Talk about a sophomore slump. I basically decided we were a franchising business. I did the very same thing my dad did. I misdirected the strategy of the business and suffered as a result and for 5 years until finally I understood my mistake and the error of my ways, luckily corrected them. And
Robert, if I can interrupt you there, this is an interesting moment in that you are finding yourself making the mistakes that your dad had made, which means that now when you look at that moment, you can say, aha, now I understand why he made those mistakes because I did it too. So where does a company leader go wrong in trying to grow a brand? I mean, the picture that you painted of the company that you took over was one that had a lot of mission drift. It had expanded way beyond its focus. And so it wasn't really able to do one thing really well. Instead, it was doing a ton of things not that well. Was that the same mistake that you repeated? And now that you look back, how do you diagnose a leader falling into that kind of problem? And what's the solution to avoiding it?
You are exactly on target. The two things I left school with were understanding the importance of strategy, what you want to be, what you want to have, which four or five levers are you going to pull to bridge scarce resources to the achievement of those objectives. We were successful doing that. And what happened was the multiple of the company was trading at 60 times earnings. And for a 30-year-old, that was intoxicating and seductive and stupid. And I tried to keep that up. And I said, well, if we can do that with a donut business, maybe we can franchise other businesses as well. So I changed the strategy and did not have in place a group of advisors and other people to ensure there was no mission creep, that I didn't make that mistake. And I was reading a book in the midst of all this called The Best and the Brightest by David Halberstam. It's about arrogance and hubris, about the Johnson and Kennedy administration of the Vietnamese War. And Halberstam could have well just been talking about me. And it was a transformational moment. So that was the moment. Luckily, before we hit the precipice, and I took everybody over with me, got some religion, understood the error of my ways, and began to fix it rather rapidly, went out, apologized to everybody for what had gone wrong, invited them in to help me fix it. We put policies and procedures in place to ensure that kind of mistake wouldn't occur again. So we were very, very crisp now about our mission, our set of objectives. Our organization was top-notch, great people. We selected great people who were highly motivated, very able, very complimentary, aspirational, and we set about making sure that we didn't make that mistake again, and we kept sticking to our knitting, and we didn't look back for the next four eras. Each of the eras in my book are written in six errors in total. So the first was great. The second was disastrous. The next four were terrific. We continued on, move from success to success. But that was the kind of learning that we went through that may be of value to others in terms of how you can get seduced by the wrong objective. And growing at 50% compounded is crazy. We would have been larger than the GDP or the GNP of the whole country in a while. Made no sense.
Can we just pause on something that he said there a second ago? He was talking about how he screwed up. He acknowledged that he screwed up. He told everybody he screwed up. He apologized for it. That is really hard, but it's also great leadership. And so I asked him.
A lot of leaders might also worry that going out and admitting failure is like saying, I don't know what I'm doing. And that could actually just cause more people to distrust you. That's not what you did. And clearly you learned that that's a good strategy, is to go out there and be humble and honest with people. Can you speak more to what you learned from that experience?
Trust is at the heart of all successful relationships and absent in all unsuccessful relationships. And the way people trust you is if you're authentic. And I don't find vulnerability to be a big thing to be shamed about. All people are human. We all make mistakes. I think the best thing I could have done was acknowledge those, change my ways. And you bear a big responsibility. If you're going to lead a business, you're responsible for lots of lives and the well-being of a lot of people. And you don't have the luxury of not getting it right and sticking, you know, come hell or high water, I'm sticking to my knitting no matter what. I find that really leadership's responsibility is 100-0. It's not 50-50. And my first reaction is when I made these mistakes, some of our franchisees rightfully became disenchanted with me and they decided to form a class action suit. My first reaction was anger. And it wasn't until I read Halberstam's book, I said, what the hell am I getting angry at the wrong people for? It's my responsibility, 100%. And quite truthfully, that kind of transformation stood me in good stead for the next 25 years. I found that when we were open, authentic, sincere, in my language, and what I can talk about in the book are the four tests of trust. But if your public and private conversations are the same, then that's sincerity, and that's one element of the four that you need for trust. You need trust with customers, you need trust with staff, and in our case, particularly, you need trust with franchise owners. So I hope that's an explanation. I was lucky. I had transformation. I also had a phenomenal team of complementary people. We were together for 20 years running that business. Trusted each other, no backbiting. I was in business with a fellow by the name of Tom Schwartz, who was the COO of the company, absolutely essential to the well-being of the company. It's another thing I found. You asked me part of the success of the business and why it grew. I say if you sort of pull back the curtain of most successful enterprises, whether a country, a community, a family, or a company, you'll oftentimes find not one person on a white horse that saves the day. They're basically a complementary set of a few people working together, maybe many more than a few. In my case, it was 12 or 15, working together, complementing each other. No one of us was expert at everything, willing to, despite our different backgrounds, different educational levels, our willingness to work together. And in fact, I don't want to sound corny, but we sort of loved each other in terms of our affection for one another and supporting each other.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to dive into Robert's four-part plan for any CEOs. He says there are four things that any CEO must be doing. It's really interesting and a nice way to break down what leadership looks like. We'll get into it all after the break. On this show, we talk to entrepreneurs who are solving problems. But what does it look like when an entire town full of entrepreneurs with problems are getting solutions? That's the premise of Small Business Revolution, an original television series by Deluxe that's launching its fifth season. In each season, the show features inspirational, moving makeovers of select small businesses from a town that America votes on, and this season, they are going to Fredonia, New York. You'll see marketing makeovers, renovations with physical spaces, and businesses and lives being changed. It's at once inspirational and insightful, with a goal of reigniting America's passion for and support of small businesses, with plenty of tips for you to take away for your own business too. You will not want to miss season 5 of Small Business Revolution in Fredonia, New York, so tune in now. You can find the show on Hulu, Prime Video, and at sbr.org/solvers. That's SBR for Small Business Revolution, sbr.org/solvers. All right, we're back. So before the break, Robert was talking about trust, and he had mentioned that trust is one of the four things that he feels a CEO must be doing. So let's dive into that list and get a good understanding of what he sees a leader's role to be.
One is you have to shepherd strategy. In other words, if the aiming point is wrong, everything that follows will generally be wrong. So you have to decide what you will be, which is your mission, and what you won't be. And that's important, what you won't devote your time and energy. Picking the right objective after the 50% compound rate growth in the first 5 years, when we throttled that back to 10 to 15%, was far more achievable, allowed us both to grow, hit our marks, keep our promises to everybody, our shareholders in particular, and still invest in the future. Second, if strategy is the first, second is organization, the ability to recruit, retain, and motivate an organization capable of executing the strategy. The third is CEO, your communicator in chief. You have to align all constituencies behind the strategy. And that's a bigger job than most people think. Oftentimes, especially I felt early on, well, I put it on paper, I gave a speech, I did my job. No, that's not how it works. We used to visit 100 stores, drive with district managers. It's a continually constant communication, listening, as well as trying to convince people to get on board. People are busy in their daily lives. They have families. They have issues that they're dealing with at home. They don't necessarily hear it the first, second, third time. It's something that has to be repeated over again. And the last but not least of the four functions that I sort of see this, the key functions of a CEO, the last one is handling crisis. All businesses face it. In our case, we had maybe three or four existential threats that could have spelled the end of the business during the 35 years I was there. And you have to be able to swing into action, and you have to be able to handle crisis. And so those are the four lenses I tell the story through each of the six eras, through the eyes of what I see as a CEO's functions. As when you remember trust, I said there are four elements to trust. That's a different, set of stories.
So I'd like to expand a little bit more on crisis, because this, of course, feels like a crisis moment for so many people, a crisis that just doesn't seem to ever end and that we don't know how long it's going to go on for. Now, this may be different from the kind of crisis that you were facing, but what is your advice to entrepreneurs about how to face these moments of instability where maybe the things that you had always grounded yourself in, the things that you thought were the things that made your business tick, might change or might not even be available to you anymore?
There would be three things that I would convey from my experience. The first is pre-prepare. I served on, I'll just mention three boards, the Dunkin' board, Domino's, and Sonic restaurants. Once a year, we would have a risk assessment. And in our case, you know, in the food business, it's very important. The health of our customers of primary importance. God forbid you should have a health scare and make someone sick. You can also have your information, your customer information hacked on a database. So we face risks. We would assess those risks to the board. They would pre-plan who would talk to who would be on the team, what kind of responses, who also faced these issues before. In our case, food maker, that's Jack in the Box, had a terrible health scare. What did they do right? What did they do wrong? Luby's, which was a cafeteria chain in Texas, had a mass shooting. And how did they handle that? What would we do if that, God forbid, were to happen to us? So pre-preparation is important. Now, a little aside, I'm going to dig a little bit. It is impossible for me to think that an enterprise as large and an institution as large as the United States government didn't do that kind of risk assessment. Second, you got to pick a small team of experts, could be outside the company, inside the company, could have been, in our case, franchise owners, as well as company management. Who are the people the most able to handle the crisis with some value add that know what they're doing? You pick them. The CEO always in those existential crises has to be a member of that team, if not leading it, has to take full responsibility for resolution, and then leave the rest of the organization to run the day-to-day business. We had to deliver the donuts and the coffee every day. If everybody was worried about a hostile takeover, which we faced, nothing would get done. Everybody would be in a huff and a tizzy. So that's important. The third thing I would recommend would be up the amount of communications. People's lives are at stake. They may not be engaged in the task force of dealing with the crisis, but their lives are affected. Their well-being are affected. People make their livelihoods from this, whether they're franchise owners or whether they're employees and staff. And that's a time when it really requires a lot of communication. And then again, that's where trust comes in. If people trust you, if you built that, put money in the bank over the years of being authentic, vulnerable, real, when you make a mistake, you acknowledge it, then people are more willing to listen through the crisis. So those would be the three things. Pre-preparation, pick a small team, let everybody else do the work. And the third thing is communicate like crazy.
And finally, I want to turn to, you just talked about a great team, and throughout our conversation here, you've talked about a great team, but I'd love to just zero in on your advice to entrepreneurs to building that great team. How do you identify great talent? How do you make sure that you're surrounding yourself with people who are going to challenge you and push you and also share the vision of the brand? It sounds like you had a really fantastic team that you had brought together and had really trusted. And I wondered what your lessons are for people to do the same.
Great question. I have three that I would recommend. The first is, you're much more likely to recruit the right person if you're very clear, and I'll use the word crisp, about defining the assignment. What exactly is the need of the enterprise at that particular moment in time? What does it need? Whether it's a board member, whether it's a marketing, whether it's technical, whatever the need is, be very clear about the assignment. And then you can more easily recruit against that assignment. So that would be the first piece of advice I would give. The second piece of advice I would give, I really got from Gallup, and it's something in putting together a team, is it's hard, if not possible, to remediate someone's weaknesses. We all come with them. We all have strengths and weaknesses. Part of emotional intelligence is understanding what you're good at and what you're not good at and being honest about that. And so we look for complementarity. We don't have to find one person who's good at everything. The team understood that, is that certain people clearly had more expertise in different areas than I ever would have dreamed of having. And having that and understanding that you're building a team of complementary skills that can work together to help one another through those issues, through building a business, are extraordinarily important. And the third thing I would look for would be sort of fit for culture. Our culture was clearly teaming. I came as a kid out of school much more comfortable with a collegial, collaborative style of leadership. So we believed in teaming. We also were very aspirational. We were very competitive. We worked hard. We placed a big amount of emphasis on integrity, because you're dealing with franchise owners and their lives. Trust is really important. So those were the kinds of activities, or those were the kind of things that defined our culture. So those would be the three things: define the assignment, hire the complementarity of the team itself, look at it as a whole, and the third is look for cultural fit.
And that is how you create value for everyone. Value in your brand for your consumers, value for your team, value that lasts, I mean, long after you've left. After I talked to Robert, this news came out a few weeks later. Dunkin' was acquired by Inspire Brands for $11.3 billion. And it's so interesting to hear the humble roots that it came from. And of course, the number of changes and mistakes and rethinking that had to go along the way. This is what longevity looks like. It is certainly not a straight line. It's a crazy zigzag, and it requires leaders who understand what the value is and what their value is, and where they fall short, and where we all need to keep going. And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to Problem Solvers wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Monday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And hey, be kind. Pass the show along to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost. And did you solve a problem that would be good for this show? Let me know about it. Visit my website, jasonfeifer.com, JasonFeifer.com, where you can find my contact information and all sorts of other valuable info. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for all your entrepreneurship needs. And even better, subscribe to our magazine, which is just full of the smartest entrepreneurs solving the toughest problems. My name is Jason Feifer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine. Thanks for listening. And hey, let's go solve some problems.